Good morning. It's great to see Scott show you some of the things. Love the demo at the end with Scott. We're going to drill down a little bit into storage options. So I'm going to spend some time talking about the various options available in Azure. And the watchword for today is about learning. And we're going to talk about learning by the basics. How do we frame the choices ahead of us? How do we think about various things? Building and deploying. So I'm going to show you a lot of the on-ramps. How do you get started? And then there are a number of topics in storage that are timely right now. Big data, NoSQL. So what we thought we'd do is take a couple of minutes near the end and spend some time talking about them more in the large, sort of what the movement is, if you will, and then maybe connect it back into some of the things we'd seen earlier in the day. Okay. So with that, that's sort of what we're going to spend the next 75 minutes doing. We have a lot of demos. We've got a couple of people coming out to show some things. So let's get started. So the basics. I'm going to spend time today talking about storage options within Azure. I'm going to focus on blob storage, which Scott mentioned briefly, table storage, and then SQL Azure Database. Going to basically spend more time where we think we need to explain a little bit more in terms of options and what's behind the scenes. The thing I want to start with, though, is for many people who've been developing applications for a long time, if you go look at the operating systems that we've dealt with, especially some of us who've done things on systems other than Windows, there have traditionally been a variety of options. There have been files, which you consider as blobs. The indexed record storage, that's an interesting one. Many operating systems, if you were familiar with Dex VMS, you had RMS. If you were an IBM mainframe guy, you had ISAM VSAM. If you had, there were ISAM-like storage options on many Unix systems. You can let RDBMS. Some operating systems came. Many distributions of Linux have a MySQL in it. So the options have been there. And developers have learned, when do I use which one? And we want to talk about that. But the point on this slide is that the choices have existed for a long, long time. And it's just been a matter of trying to figure out when to use the right one for the appropriate job. I'm going to spend a little bit of time on that today. The last one here is queues. Now, in Windows Azure, we have two forms of queues. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about this. The only reason I mention it here is to highlight that there's a queues option within storage, which you can think about more. I think about it more as an inter-back-end service sort of thing. What Scott demonstrated from Event Day is the service bus, which is more of a full-featured pub-sub to build out applications, subscribe to topics, and whatnot. So differences there. I think just realizing there are two forms and spending a little time, when do I use each one? I'm not going to talk about it further other than say that queues are one of the things you'll find underneath storage accounts when we drill into that. So now let's take a look at the Azure options. I tried to build a little bit of a concept map here. So we have Azure Storage, which contains blobs, tables, and queues. And we're going to focus on those. And there are a set of attributes associated with each storage account that you provision. There's a region, so you can pick where that the storage is primarily located. You have a quota that's associated across all the different forms of storage. And then you have a set of access keys that allow you access to your data. The options themselves, we mentioned blobs, tables, queues. And then there are file system options within Azure. You have local storage, part of the file system that's associated with the virtual machine you may be running on. That is not persistent in the sense that it is guaranteed to survive restart of the machine. So if the machine gets serviced, if it fails, you wind up moving somewhere else, you can't guarantee that that storage is available. There's also a Windows Azure Drives, which is a remotely mountable file system, which is persistent. Okay, so more traditional types of file systems there, one persistent and non-persistent form. On the SQL Azure side, point I want to make here is that the product that we sell today in the box, SQL Server, is not just the relational database engine. It also includes reporting, it includes ETL, it includes the analysis services. So it's not even just relational storage. But the name of the product and the brand is SQL Server. Sort of by analogy in the cloud, SQL Azure is growing, will grow to encompass more of the things that we associate with sort of the larger information platform, information management, ETL, reporting, analytics, the BI elements as well. You can see some of that starting today. We started with the relational database engine, SQL Azure. We've added in CTP SQL reporting, SQL Azure reporting, and SQL Azure Data Sync. So you'll continue to see things. So that, again, the thing to take away here is to think about it more of the full-service information platform. And as we get into it later on in the talk, we'll talk about the differences between the on-premises version and SQL Azure, the Azure options. So here's the on-ramp. You've probably seen the portal several times already. Hopefully you have. Everything's available at the portal. So you go there. Two I highlighted here. That's where you can find everything we're going to talk about for the next 70 minutes in the storage account option and then in database. We're not going to spend time on data sync, but again, that is part of what we'll talk going forward with SQL Azure. So quickly, talk about blob storage. The blob service is contained within the storage account. We've mentioned that earlier. You do have a hierarchical namespace. It's a RESTful interface, and you can get and put blobs. Now, there are two types of blobs backed by the system. There's a page and a block blob. In the block blob case, it's a little bit easier for you to parallelize large updates. The page one's easier for you to do updates in place, more meant for that. There are other differences. For most needs, I suspect for 80% of the use cases, 80% of the people using the blob service, you don't really need to concern yourself with the distinction. But a good thing to just file away is that there is a distinction, and I think you can read through in the documentation very quickly to find it out and then determine what's best for your use. That's not something you have to worry about to get started, though, but just realize there are two different forms of blobs there. Another thing that's sort of interesting here, and this you'll see this in a number of the services, that underneath the covers, we support a RESTful interface, and it is true to form best practices. And Scott mentioned, Scott Guthrie, at the close of his talk, that we're going to be open sourcing the libraries. And for those of you who have been in this space looking around, typically what goes on is the service provider, the platform will provide a RESTful interface, which allows someone to go build a client library. So if most clients have an HTTP stack of some form, a lot of people just as conveniences build a client library such as you're not dealing at the HTTP verb level. And again, same thing here. So that's it for the blob service. Pretty straightforward, really easy. There's a storage explorer, one thing I should mention, on CodePlex. There's an Azure Storage Explorer, which is kind of neat to get in, kind of poke around in the storage options as well. So that's an interesting tool to make use of. Table storage. Table storage is a service meant to be get at from afar that contains, it's again within a storage account, tables or collections. Now, if you come from the relational database side, don't think tables in terms of I go off and define a schema. I think of it more as a collection. And what I choose to place in that collection are entities, and I'll describe what I mean by that in a second. And think of them as being property bags. I have, I'll talk about the keys in a second, but I have a set of properties with a set of types. I can bring those all together on a single entity, and I don't necessarily have to have the same schema or property set type for each entity, if you will, within a table. So I can do some things. Now, as you get into it, the things you will find, there's a partitioning key and there's a row key. So a partition key and a row key. Those uniquely identify an entity within the table service. Furthermore, things that are placed within the same partition key will reside on the same back-end storage server. So you'll get locality there. You're able to design a set of hierarchical layouts based upon the combination of these two keys, the partition key and the row key. Now, here's a thing that, again, to file away. You can create a composite row key that allows you to build nested structures, but that's something that you would have to manage yourself. The reason that the partition key is made available to the system is that is the unit in terms of how things are laid out in the back-end service. So there's also a notion of a entity group transaction. So if things take place within a single partition key, they will be atomic. I'll come back to some of this a little bit later when we get into it from the SQL Azure Federation side. But again, there's a key for each row. The rest of the row, you can think of it just a property set. You get some type, name, and values you associate with it. Very, very simple. And if we go, and I'll just kind of foreshadow things we'll talk about in the NoSQL movement, people, many developers, just they want an entity model. I want to think about things, but I don't really want to be concerned with how I have to bring fully normalize and bring three tables together to build a customer, if you will, or two or three tables to go build an order. So if we can just bring things together, you will still have relationships that are natural at the entity level, such I may have a user and a set of blog posts. In this case, I have movies and actors. And being able to relate those, you can store a key in one to refer to a collection in the other. So you build up, if you will, the entity relationship model in a entity store or the table service in those means rather than describing joins. So don't have to do the joins to create a particular entity, and then you can use links, if you will, to associate things to build up your data model that way. So with that, I'm going to invite David Robinson out, who is going to come out several times. He's going to do some Azure Table Storage stuff. He's going to do some SQL Azure stuff. So you are going to be with me here for a little bit.
A little bit, yeah.
So take it away, David.
So good afternoon. How's everybody doing? Good. How's everybody at home doing?
Yeah.
No, not that
great.
Good.
We'll assume it's
not
great.
Not that good. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I'm going to take you through a very quick demo demonstrating how easy it is to use the table service. I'm actually going to use the same movies that you just discussed a little while ago.
Okay.
So the first thing I'm going to do is fire up Visual Studio. And it's a project I've already built. It's always safer to have pre-built, you know, projects than it is, you know, writing code on the fly. I'm not as brave as Scott Guthrie, so, you know, taking the safe route out. And the first thing we can actually see here is my movies entity. And if I just zoom in a little bit, very simple. I have a property for actors, a property for movie name, a URL for the thumbnail of the actual of the video as well. The second thing.
So in your case, you're using a date as the partition key.
I am
so
using
everything
a date.
For a single day will be
in its own partition.
Yep.
That's correct. The next thing I want to actually look at is the actual data context. And if I scroll down a little bit here, I can actually see that I'm inheriting from table service contract context, which is part of the Azure SDK library that you mentioned is going to be open sourced. We're also defining an iQueryable for the movie entity. And the magic, all the actual CRUD operations all happens right here in the entity data source. And this is, you know, where all the magic happens. And so if we look at the constructor, we could see we're pulling the data connection string from our configuration file that we'll look at in one moment. And we're getting everything all ready to go. If we look at the actual data source, we can actually see the link query here to actually do a select on that, passing in the partition key. And if we scroll down just a little bit more, we could see what happens when we do an add and also when we do an update. Pretty simple stuff. Like I said before, if I actually look here at my configuration file, I'm actually have a statement here that says use development storage equals true. What this basically means is that I'm running on the local Windows Azure dev environment. I don't have to worry about if I'm connected to the cloud, if I'm working on an airplane. You know, I used to spend a lot of time traveling, got a lot of coding done on airplanes. I'm able to work isolated, and then when I'm ready to deploy it up to Windows Azure, I just copy in my key like you mentioned a little while ago. So very simple, if I just go ahead and run this application, give it a second to deploy it to the emulator, and it'll fire up in just one moment.
So while it's doing this, one of the things that we should mention is that by grouping by date,
correct,
everything that you scan will in there will be more efficient because you're not going across the storage servers in the back end. So, but there's a trade-off in terms of co-locality there versus how much a single machine in the back end could handle. So if we were just blasting a whole bunch, we may want to construct our partition key differently to spread the load. So this is something you should get into.
Yeah, and that's
how to
more
really
about
the most out of
this. And what the scenario and the use case of the application is, you know?
Right, so if I elevate that, understand that you can do some interesting things just by how you reason about the keys, the partition key and the row key.
Exactly, exactly. So what's your favorite movie?
Oh, my favorite movie. How about What About Bob?
Really?
I don't know.
What about
you
Bob?
Know my favorite.
I would have said something different. Who was in What About Bob?
Bill Murray was in What About Bob.
Well, see, that's how up to date on that movie I am.
Well, look at, I've been around for a while, David.
Yes, it shows.
Yeah, thanks.
And so if I select an image, I can just go ahead and save that out there. And I'm going to, that's not supposed to happen.
Create if not exist, remote server return an error. Bad.
Ooh, bad request.
You did a bad request on the local
server. Let me actually just go ahead and switch to, that one did too.
Must be user error.
It must absolutely
be. The movie is so obscure that something.
That's exactly it. So if I would have chosen a different movie, I bet you it would have worked.
Okay.
So,
my fault.
So that was his first demo.
Okay.
So.
All right. Sounds good. So you're going to wrap it there?
I'm going to wrap it there.
Okay.
Yeah. No continuing on this one.
We'll go back to the slides and you can figure out what happened there. Maybe come back to it. Okay. So that's the table service. And we'll figure out why we wound up with where we wound up on the exception.
We are.
I am going to switch over. We're going to talk about the SQL Azure database. Spend a bunch of time there. Now, this is the question. What is SQL Azure database? Now, this is an interesting thing to describe here. Because on one hand, over here, it's just SQL Server. That's the what we want to provide. On the other hand, it is a true service in the sense that it is a platform service. So I'm going to spend a fair bit of time trying to distinguish between those. And perhaps the one of the more interesting ways of saying is that for those people who have been around a while and thought about email as an example. So on the one hand, there were a lot of people time back who were running their own SMTP server, their own IMAP, their own POP3. And so you had to be concerned on all sorts of things, all sorts of physical management. Today, most people are comfortable just provisioning an email account. You have to put in the SMTP server as an address you're binding to. That's not necessarily guaranteed to be a single SMTP server on a single VM. In fact, here's another way of thinking about it. It would be kind of crazy for people to offer these large-scale email services by giving everyone a VM, an SMTP server, and POP and IMAP server in a VM. But we're used to this service now, which came from a world in which we were provisioning servers, to where it's just the service and we bind to it now. That's sort of the same transition that we're affecting with SQL Azure. And we'll talk about some of the differences and some of the advantages in our doing that. So it is the same database technology in the engine sense. In fact, what we've done over the last year is we have the work that we had done on behalf of SQL Azure, we've brought it together in a common source base, a common source code base. And so features and capabilities that we bring into the platform later on, they may show up in the service side, they may show up on the database side. So it's a really interesting time for us as a development team in this. So one of the things we'll show later on is provisioning your server. So if you go back to the email analogy, when you provision yourself, you're not firing up an SMTP service. In SQL Server, we have the notion of a server and a master database, and we've virtualized those in SQL Azure. So you create a server, which looks as much like a regular server as we can make it look, but it is not a physical server running in a VM. It is a proxy for a server, and so that's some of the advantage we get out of it, some of the advantage you get out of it. So one of the things that we are doing with this, just like go back to the email analogy, we're separating logical and physical administration. So if you're getting the email service from someone else, you don't have to worry about, do I have the disk space for new stuff? I don't have to worry about, if a disk goes bad, how to manage that. Same thing with SQL Azure. Don't need to worry about that. Don't need to worry about managing the log. Don't need to worry about the physical administration piece. You're still responsible for what is the logical schema? How do I tune my queries? So physical and logical administration, teasing those apart. Okay? And we'll talk about some of that. We're also doing a lot of work to automate the provisioning. So we have people who have a model whereby they want to provision a database per tenant and making that really easy so that when I onboard someone, I can just provision them another database and go. That's one of the things we're working towards. So as Scott had mentioned several times, pay-as-you-go pricing. We've just announced with the shift this weekend, changes in capacity, changes in the pricing model of SQL Azure. You can take a peek at that on the calculator. There's one thing here that I want to mention in terms of, you know, as we go forward, people have asked, you know, 150 gigabytes, we've just announced support for that. We initially announced 1 in 10 gigabyte, and there were all sorts of, why 10 gigabytes, I can't do real work in that. So here's the reason, because I was right on the team at that point we did it, is that we wanted people to just walk up, sign up, and have a good experience. And anyone here who's a database pro realizes that you get a 100 gigabyte database and you don't have indexed properly, you could not have a good experience. So we're trying to, you know, grow along with people, figure out how we automate more, how we ensure a good experience. There's no hard architectural limit in terms of the largest size of the database. And we'll also describe later on a new option that we call federations to allow you to scale out a single logical database in a way that makes sense in this environment as well. So, again, thing to take away, this size you see here is something we'll grow over time, and it's not a hard architectural thing. It's as much as people get comfortable and we know how to provide a great experience at whatever the maximum size is. So, with that, talk about building and deploying your database. I'm not going to talk to all of the stuff on this slide by any means. A couple points I'll highlight, several I already mentioned. The focus on logical versus physical administration. Database log files automatically managed. Tables do require a clustered index. We had this interesting sort of choice as we moved to cloud. We had a number of things in the existing product, the on-premises product, where I could tell people, you know, in these days, there's really, if you're going to have an index on a table, there's really no reason to not have it be a clustered index, etc. And things just made it easier for us on the service side, so we kind of mandated them. It's caused a little bit of a, you know, speed bump to get stuff over, but it's going to make all of our lives easier going forward. And there are some unsupported SQL Server features. Some of them are just the fact that they don't really have an analog if we're not talking about a server, or there's no way that we could ever do it in a way that would make sense. So one that's not listed here, but for people who do know the product, kind of makes a lot of sense, is we still support, from way back when, extended stored procedures. So you write some code and run it in the address space of the server. That's a recipe for you got to know what you're doing. And that's not something that we could ever do credibly in a shared service environment without a ton of work. So we're not going to allow extended stored procedures. So there's an explanation for that. Other sorts of things we may open up again as we get more experience here. SQL CLR, we've already done some things with XML. So you'll see more and more capabilities, more and more parity. What we're looking for right now are, what are the inhibitors? So if you have feedback in terms of, yeah, I like SQL Azure, but I need this particular capability before I could make my move, please, please let us know, because we're actually doing a lot of our prioritization based upon the feedback we hear there. Okay, so now, another interesting thing, and what I'm trying to do is give you a sense for what it looks like from our side, and I think that helps explain some things where if you don't know what it looks like from our side, it, you know, may look funny. Just as with, I'll go back to the email analogy, SMTP, IMAP, POP3, those were not RESTful protocols. They actually, in many cases, require a client library on the other side. SQL Server has a protocol in use called TDS. It's been around for a long, long time, been evolved. There are open source implementations of it. There are implementations that we have done and will do on non-Windows environments. Now, that also means, though, we may have people, and we want to have people, building things at the other end that are not symmetric in the sense of just a Windows machine there. And so in that case, what we want is people to be able to have a logical data administration tool to create tables, create indexes, do some work on the data without having to have all of the rich tools that we... It's a lightweight way for people to walk up, even people who may have Visual Studio installed. And for those people that come from different environments, it's a way for them to use SQL Azure, create tables, create indexes, and do work at the logical data administration level. So that's a thin client database development tooling. There's also a very rich client database development. SQL Server data tools, work that we've done to basically bring a first-class development experience within Visual Studio to development. Also, enhancements in SQL Server Management Studio. You can just attach from Management Studio to SQL Azure and manage it much like you would any other SQL database. So with that, I believe David is going to maybe tell us what happened. Are you going to show
I'm actually redeeming myself here.
Okay,
so
all right.
There was a typo right here where we were...
But you didn't type the code in. You just cut and paste.
Yes. Okay. I'm not going to talk about the men behind the curtain, but as we see, we have two movies here.
Yeah.
One story is of a Microsoft Technical Fellow.
There we go.
Starring you, and obviously, what about Bob? Because, you know, pay homage. So let's get out of this demo and talk about how we can go ahead and create a new SQL Azure server and what that all looks like. So to begin with, I'm going to go out to the Windows Azure portal. I'm sure you saw this extensively when Scott was doing his presentations. Let me just log in really quick.
Isn't it hard to type when you've got all these people here?
No, it's not hard to type. It's, you know, it's just all these credentials we have here. You know, everybody has a different way of saying pass at word one. You know, can't we just standardize on that?
Yeah, there you go.
But this is actually my domain cred, so I can't share that with the audience.
Yes, don't do that.
That would be bad. So here we are. We're in the process of logging into the portal. It's going ahead and federating with our AD just to log in via the live ID. Let's give this a second. Here it goes. It's going to download the Silverlight Zap file, as we see here. And just as Dave pointed out a little while ago, everything that we see is down here in the left-hand side on the accordion. We're going to spend most of our time here on the database tab. Now, if I go ahead and click on the database tab, it's going to load into a different view, and I get to see all the different subscriptions I have on the Windows Azure platform. And I have one specifically that I set up for today called Windows Azure Learn Demo. Now, before SQL Azure came along, how hard was it to go ahead and create a new server?
Depends on who you were.
Yeah, exactly. But you had to go ahead and you had to buy machines, you had to rack servers, you had to install software. It took some time.
Mm-hmm.
Creating a new server on SQL Azure is very simple. All I need to do is click on this create button right up on the top, and it launches me into a wizard. Now, the first thing I must do in order to create this server is I need to go ahead and choose where this server is going to be located in. That's a very important thing to consider. It's important for multiple reasons. Number one, you're going to want to make sure that the code that's running up on Windows Azure Compute is running close to where the data is located, mm-hmm. so you don't have to deal with the latency of the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, depending on the type of application, you might want to have it located geographically close to where all your users are located. So for this demo, I'm just simply going to choose the North Central U.S. Data Center. I'm going to go ahead and click Next. I'm going to type in my administrator login with my pass at word one. Now, one interesting thing to call out here is the administrator login.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the stuff that we've done from a security perspective is to make sure that your SQL Azure databases and servers are secure. So as we look at, you know, viruses like Slammer and things like, you know, what are the most commonly brute-forced attacked usernames, so we've gone ahead and we've come up with that list and we've ensured that you're unable to go ahead and create a username with, for instance, SA mm-hmm. or admin or root or administrator, just as another level of defense. The next thing I can go ahead and click Next. And one of the things that we've told people for many years is do not expose your SQL Server to the internet.
Yep.
And what did we do? We put SQL Azure up on the internet.
But wait, there's more.
One of the things that we built into the system is a firewall mm-hmm. to enable you to only allow specific lists of IP addresses to go ahead and connect to that server.
So we should talk about the topology while you type.
Okay.
In the sense that the most common scenarios, you're going to have logic running in the data center next to the database. Opening up this allows you to get at for remote administration, development.
Exactly.
So you may want to just open up the firewall, close it back down, and then go from your web front end and then have the logic running on your back end.
That's correct. And one of the helpful things here is it actually gives me what my IP address is just in case I want
it.
And, you know, perhaps I'm behind a NAT and I don't know.
Yep.
My IP address might be 192, but that's the external one. Let me go ahead and click OK. And click Finish. But before I do that, you had pointed out the thin client development tools that we have, something called the Database Manager. Mm-hmm. If I wanted only Windows Azure applications to be able to access my server, I would just simply need to be able to click that checkbox.
Yes.
And I'd be able to use the lightweight tools.
Yep. Because that is a case going through the web, and then it's talking behind,
exactly,
inside Azure.
Exactly. Yeah. So let me go ahead and click Finish. Give it a moment to go ahead and provision that. So now I have a brand new server I'm able to go ahead and start to work with. So let me go ahead and, just for fun, let me come down here. Not that one. Let's do this one. So this is the brand new server I've created. I could see right here, I'm the administrator. I could see I have two firewall rules. Here's my master database that we have. And I could also see that I have a database quota of 150. So basically what that means is I'm able to create 150 databases before I have to enter into a more formal relationship with Microsoft with credit checks and things of that nature. If I go ahead and copy out this DNS name, I can go ahead and use my old friend SQL Server Management Studio. Just paste that in there.
So again, this is the virtualized server that we talked about earlier. We didn't spin up a VM just to host this on the back end.
No, we did not. And in one moment, there we go. So now I can go ahead and start to use the same tools that I use on SQL Server on-premise, I can go ahead and start to use with my cloud database. So that's how you create the server. Let's go ahead and launch into Visual Studio so we can actually do something a little bit more interesting. So on the left here, we see our SQL Server Object Explorer right here. Let me go ahead and just open that up and say add SQL Server. And I want to go ahead and use my local SQL Express. I just want to create a dummy database that I can go ahead and start to work with. As you see, we've practiced this demo a couple times. So let's do Customers 3.
Oh, that's where that other typo came from.
Yeah. I hate this keyboard, I got to tell you. I've got to talk to those people back there.
Yeah.
Let me go ahead and do a new query. And then I have some handy SQL right here. I'm just going to copy out and paste in here. And so what I'm basically doing is creating a very simple database. If I go ahead and right-click and execute. And it's gone ahead and created a table, inserted some data into it. So now I have, you know, we're back into the year 2005, 2008. I have an on-premise database.
Yep.
The interesting part now is I can go ahead, I can right-click on this database, and I could say, create new project. It's going to go ahead and take the schema that I've just defined. Let's do database 5 just to be safe. And it's going to create a brand new database project based on SQL Server developer tools, and so that I can go ahead and start to operate on that. And so give it a second. It's going to go, it's going to look at the schema, it's going to look at everything, it's going to pull it all out and create my project for me. So let me go ahead and finish, and so it's extracted everything out, and I can see the table that I had created. Mm-hmm. This is the magical part. Let me right-click on the database and go into Properties. Now, you mentioned for a second, you know, first-class development environment for SQL Server. You also mentioned that there are some differences between SQL Azure and SQL Server on-premise.
And some differences between SQL Server 2005, 2008.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. The beauty of this is that I can go ahead and just simply say I want to target SQL Azure. That's my target platform. And now this development tool, Visual Studio, combined with SQL Server development tools, will keep me within the rails of what I'm allowed to do on this version.
So
of
we factored out the language services associated with each release. And
that
we
is
can
correct.
Do static checking. And
that is absolutely correct. So now I can go ahead and save that. Let me go back to the portal for a second. Copy this guy back out. Yes, I want that. And now I can go ahead and say right-click. I can go ahead and say publish. Let me save that solution. Sure, I want to save it. And let me go ahead and click edit. Let me go ahead and click paste because I want to deploy it up to the cloud. Let me type in my creds. And let me go OK. And let me just go ahead and say publish. And so now what it's doing, it's going ahead, packaging everything up.
Yep.
It knows what's compatible with SQL Azure, making sure it's doing its static code analysis and moving the database out there. So now if you just give it one more second, I should be able to come back here, do a refresh. And then if I open that back up, there's database 5 that I've now moved.
So you've moved it up there. And you, furthermore, you know that the Transact SQL you have in there is compatible with SQL Azure.
Exactly. Yep. And the great part about this also is that if I want to go ahead, because one of the things that we do constantly in development is there's never, you know, we don't just say this is a database. We're always adding additional things to it, or, you know, additional tables, stored procedures, making changes. SQL Server Development Tools allows me to go ahead and make those changes and automatically upgrade the database on further publishing.
Yep.
So it's a really phenomenal tool.
Good. Super. That
successful demo.
How about that? Thanks.
Let's go.
Good. All right, so with that, let's go back to slides. So we talked about, you know, getting into it, the on-ramp, how to get started. There's actually a question up here. Without backup restore, what are the options for moving your current database to SQL Azure? David just demonstrated one way, but as I tend to tell people, you typically only hit F5 on a database or F6 on a database once, and then it's pretty much evolution, and so moving things around. Those of you familiar with SQL Server and the efforts we put into the DAC, over the last release or two, that will be fully supported in SQL Azure. And another thing that I'll mention, we're really working to take friction out of various places. A little example of that is in the firewall, giving you your external IP address so that you don't have to go foraging around for that. You know, getting it easy to pull a database up there. I'm actually going to show you an example on the DAC demonstration here. There's an interactive approach right now for publishing a database up there. If you remember 15 or 20 minutes ago, I mentioned that we have customers who want to be able to provision a database per tenant, if you will. The next one for Backpack V2 is the ability to load it into Azure Storage, Blob Storage we talked about earlier, and then be able to reference it within the portal to go instantiate another database, so further taking friction out of the deployment of databases. Okay? So that's how you can go do it at scale. Now, next thing, and David's going to show us this as well, for those of you who are database wonks, there's this whole debate on the consistency versus eventual consistency, ACID, base, and one of the things that, as I talk to people about it, is that we really need to understand that there are options and shades of gray. To me, the real question is consistency at what scale, at what cost? Because if you make things such that they're not consistent down to a very fine grain, you're putting a tremendous burden on a developer to be able to put things back together. On the other end of the spectrum, it is exceedingly hard and provably impossible to have scale-out transparency, partition tolerance, and whatnot at a very, very large scale. So the question is, where do we, you know, make the decision, where do we break things up? One of the first deployments of the underlying engine for SQL Azure was for a service that Microsoft offers called Exchange Hosted Archive. And the initial deployment was almost 800 nodes in the cluster. And we did it in what would be a sharded or federated approach. So it was a single multi-tenant database, common schema across all of the nodes, if you will. And when we went to do an alter table, we didn't run a gigantic distributed transaction across all eight, because you get up near 1,000 nodes, there's a fairly good chance that someone's going to be, you know, misbehaving when you try to do that. And so what we would do is just run the alter table as a workflow, and then if one of them didn't finish, we could kind of kick it and you'd get there. The point being is the way we do things today, we can't really transact an application change with a database change. So when we alter table, we make it in a forward-compatible way with respect to the app. Once that's done, we deploy the new app. So if we don't have one huge transaction doing it in the large, we haven't lost anything in terms of consistency, but we've gained something in the sense that we don't need to do it in one large distributed transaction, which is more prone to failure at scale than the other approach. Okay? So this is sort of the trade-offs that you can file away. How that comes forward in SQL Azure is a feature we call federations. And David's going to prove that just taking our favorite database. Is that sort of...
That is our favorite database.
AdventureWorks.
At least it's my favorite database.
AdventureWorks.
You know, I thought yours was Northwind.
You're kicking me.
Anything coming from, you know, Fabricam and, you know, all those great tools.
For those of you who don't know, Northwind was the old demo database that came with SQL Server, and AdventureWorks is the new one.
And we have a new version of AdventureWorks that I'm going to show in a couple minutes.
All right.
So basically what I've gone ahead and done is I've started at the management portal. I have a different server that I've already set up for this demo. And on that, I have a bunch of different AdventureWorks databases. So this is a standard AdventureWorks database that I've loaded with a ton of data for a demo that we'll take a look at in a couple minutes. I simply clicked on the Manage button, and I was able to launch into this lightweight version, the Database Manager. And from here, I could see AdventureWorks. I can go ahead and I could see what the CPU utilization has been like, the different database properties. I could see how full the database is. I could see the maximum size is 50 gigabytes, which was just increased to 150 over the last day. I can go ahead and do queries if I want. It's very, very, you know, familiar. Actually, let's do a select count. And I can go ahead and run that. Pretty interesting stuff. If I go back to this, I see I have another one called AdventureWorks Fed. If I come down, scroll down over here, and take a look, there's a new box down here that says Has Federations and it's set to true. So what I've gone ahead was, I've gone ahead and taken the standard AdventureWorks database that we all know and love, and I've gone ahead and I federated it. And the way I did that is if you take a look at the SQL script that I ran previously, there's a bunch of other syntax that I've added to the top and some additional syntax I've added to the table creates of certain tables that I want to go ahead and federate. So the statement create federation, customer federation, cust ID int range basically says I want to create a federation, I want to shard my database, and I want the customer ID to be the thing that it gets, you know, sharded on. That was number one. Number two, I went ahead and said, okay, this is a brand new federation. Let me go ahead and use the use statement with the word federation to go ahead and direct the connection into the first shard. As you can see here, the product table, these are tables that are common to all the shards, so I'm not federating on those tables. But if you go down to the more interesting tables, like, for instance, the customers table, I want this to be federation aware. I want to ensure that when I go ahead and I insert a new customer, I go ahead and specify, when I specify the customer ID, the system will automatically put that in the appropriate shard.
So it's a way of logically partitioning. The reason we're careful not to use the word partition in the database sense is it means it's the correct word abstractly, but it has other
meanings. Yes.
Yeah. So, sort of in the vernacular, in terms of how this has played out, sharding is the word that a lot of people have used.
The pattern that's common.
The pattern.
Most, yeah.
So we've just basically taken the pattern and sort of introduced it to the system.
That's correct. So if you go ahead and go back here for a moment. We said we had, and look, there's 5 million customers in the standard standard AdventureWorks database. And since this database is a 50 gigabyte database, we figured why not go ahead and create a sharded database of one gig databases, but 50 of them. And to go ahead and take a look at that, I can simply go to the management portal, click on AdventureWorks Fed, go ahead and click Manage, and the view I'm going to get is going to be subtly different. Let me go ahead and log in here.
While you're doing that, just as we talked about earlier, how you have the ability to spread out I/O in terms of how you define these keys, whether they're going to one logical partition or multiple logical partitions. Same thing here.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, we've done, remember back in the day when SQL Azure or SQL Server Data Services wasn't like anything it is today, I'd given many talks about, you know, why people have to partition. You know, is it for storing more data or is it for the workload characteristics? As we can see here, now that this is a federated database, I can actually see the customer federation has 50 members, and I can go ahead and click on this arrow right here, and it's going to give me a really, really interesting view once it finishes initializing.
So this is an interesting point. So in the debate, I'm going to spend some more time talking with the community topics, talk NoSQL and whatnot, but these things are not all coupled. One can add this sharding and federation support to achieve loosely coupled scaling in a relational database and not throw out all the other advantages. And so that's
it's kind of the best of both worlds type situation. So I can see here a view down here at the bottom showing all the different members in this federation. And if I click on a single one, I can actually see things like you know, how big it is, what's the use size, free size. If I want to go ahead and let's say, for instance, this shard is starting to fill up, mm-hmm. or perhaps it's becoming really hot from a transactional CPU perspective, I can actually go ahead and click on split and say, I want to split this and specify what the customer ID is that you want to go ahead and do that split upon. And that's an online operation. Mm-hmm. So if you think about this for a second, I now have two different versions of AdventureWorks. I have the standard one, 50 gig, you know, one set of CPU, one set of memory. And then I have the federated one, which is 50 databases, 50 sets of CPU, 50 sets of memory. And so I'm able to do much more, mm-hmm. you know, from a transactional, much more from a database load perspective. So one of the things we did this weekend was we wrote a quick app, and keep in mind, actually it's a funny joke, what do they call developers who write crappy code?
Program managers.
Program managers, exactly. Exactly. I think I might have used that one with you before.
No, I hadn't heard it before, but I just knew the answer.
Yes.
Oh, I'm going to get a ton of crud when I go back to my house.
Exactly. So if I go
but
ahead,
developers can't write specs or talk to customers. Sometimes
that's so true. That's true. Yeah. So if I go ahead here, so I have a stress application running. So this is running. Can I zoom in? Zoom it with the. I can't.
It's pretty big. I think people
they can see that.
Yeah.
So on the left-hand side, what you see here is a stress application. We wrote a couple stored procedures to really go ahead and do a lot of operations on the database. We have 50 threads, so basically 50 threads connecting to the database, selecting a random customer, performing some processing on it.
And you didn't try to tune anything here, so this should not be seen as the ultimate. This is just you took the same thing, one federated.
By all means, yeah, this is not a benchmark.
Not scientific in any form.
This is not a benchmark. If we go ahead, and this actually looks like it might have hung, but if we go ahead and look at the federated version, we're doing, you know, 105 transactions a second compared to the 2.8 over here.
So the point is that you can federate to just distribute I.O. load.
Correct.
And also federate just to manage space.
That is correct.
And okay, good. Good.
And so that's it. So as that's running, if like I said, if I really want to, let's say this partition all the way out here, he looks like he's getting full. He's about 26% full. I could simply go ahead and click split, and I could say I want to split on the...
You have values here in which you can determine where you want to split on.
Exactly. Yep. Exactly. Yep. And go ahead and click split. It's going to go ahead and kick on that kick off that operation, and in a few minutes...
And as you said, that's online.
And that's an online operation.
Great. Great. Good.
So that's federations.
Thank you, David.
You're welcome.
And you got it all to work in the end.
We got it all to work. That's
right.
Dave. I'll see you soon.
Great. Thanks for your time.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, David. All right. Cool. Okay, so a couple things to highlight here. One, there's a common pattern with some of these federated workloads where I have transactional work where I want to go find the customer of interest, I want to go find the order of interest, I want to go and just direct to the federation or the shard, if you will, that holds the data, go in and do your transaction. You have the surrounding data for it, you can complete it. And then in many of those scenarios, what people also want to do in concert with that is to run queries, mostly for analytic work, across all of the federations. And so we'll be doing a bunch of that. You could imagine us elevating the forms of queries and getting more sophisticated over time in terms of how we use this. But we've established the basis with the federation support. The other thing that I want to talk about here is that we have been careful about separating mechanism and policy. And I'll go back to that point I made around logical and physical administration. Ultimately, we want to get to a point here where you can specify a policy for when you may want to split a partition. If things get too hot, response times aren't sufficient, and we know that a split would help serve you. And then we could take that action on your behalf. But we're providing the online mechanism so that you can do it yourself out of the gate. The other thing that, for us, again, from our perspective, we're really in this interesting space where building a cloud service, you have to imagine that as we've shipped SQL Server on 2, 3, and sometimes longer release cadences, it's dead reckoning, but in a long time between we're taking fixes, meaning in terms of the courses. Here in the cloud space, we can learn and iterate and move things forward. Now, there's a balance between having a bunch of stuff come at you that it's just you feel inundated, but our ability to refine, respond, and learn in the new cloud service space is incredible for us, and we're already realizing the benefit of that. So there's sort of the federation support. And I want to switch now to these community-led topics that I was talking about. And As I was doing the deck, kind of putting the pieces to the deck together with others, I was wondering, okay, should we start with these topics? Should we end with these topics? In the end, I kind of left them sort of near the tail. And the reason is I felt it would be easier to go back and back-reference some of the things we talked about rather than setting it all up and then having to connect the dots. So one of the things that I did a little over a year ago, there was a lot going on in the NoSQL space. It wasn't very well understood. Wasn't very well understood inside. So I spent a morning and just kind of went through, collected up a bunch of stuff I had read. I built a mind map. And one of the things I was trying to dig out, what are the orthogonal dimensions? Where are people finding value? Instead of saying it's all NoSQL, it's relational, two people, you know, side screaming at each other. And some of the things, this is not the full model, but it's the elements or the dimensions that are relevant for the things we've talked about today. So this notion of an entity model, the fact that I want to be reasoning about customers and movies and orders, but I don't really want to have to be concerned about all of the fully normalized relational schema, the tables I need to join to produce a customer. So this notion of dynamic schema, can I, you know, alter things without having to be a scale of data size operation, flexible schema? Can I have a variable schema per entity? Those are things that sort of came into that dimension. Now, the point I want to make is not to try to overfit, but to say that if you come from the relational database side, we have things to make that much easier for you and still have it be a relational database under the covers. So the entity framework, and in particular, the code first work that we've done recently in the entity framework, make it much easier for a developer who just wants a database to result from his work underneath to do that without having to become a schema design expert to go off and pull that off. In the case of Azure Table Storage, we have an inherent model that is about dynamic schema, flexible schema, and kind of try to teach you a few things about how you can reason about the partition key and the row key to do different forms of both information model and in the layout to get different characteristics out of the system. Horizontal scalability. Can I get the system, can it continue to grow without pinch points arising? Now, it's very, very difficult to build scaled out, very large, transparently scaled out systems. And there are a number of companies, and you can go, you know, find and read this. This is something that I ran into during the first dot-com sort of craze back, you know, around the 2000 or whatnot. There were large customers who had big boxes, big databases, all in one, and if they had a problem, they'd put up the banner saying, sorry, we're down, you know, come back later. Many of these people did their own patterns to do, in essence, what became the pattern around sharding, and that's the way that they got the system to scale. They realized other advantages as well. For example, if you're an auction site and you go and you say, look, I'm going to split out and have 500 auction servers. If one of them, you know, goes up in smoke, I've only affected 1/500th of my population and the rest of the folks can keep going. And they also looked, okay, user profiles and feedback are important to us. Those are different data. And I think about user profiles, I don't change my address or credit card number all that often. So by recognizing the different characteristics of data, they were able to basically shard it differently. So they achieved horizontal scalability by building patterns on top of existing technologies. As we just demonstrated, some of these are now becoming part of the new system. So we can get this simple sharding. It is inherent in the Azure table. It just happens as a side effect of what my partitioning key is, my partition key. In SQL Azure, you need to do a little bit more upfront thinking in terms of how you want to factor things, but you can still achieve this notion of scalability without being coupled and the ability to manage things as one. So again, dimension of horizontal scalability, there are ways of getting at it from several different sides. Simple availability. This notion of trading consistency for availability. Now, as a, you know, dyed-in-the-wool old transactional guy, actually one of the first things I did at Microsoft, for the folks who've been around with the product for a long time, I put in the resource manager support for the distributed transaction coordinator. So one of the first things I did here was all about transactions, and then I wound up writing the lock manager and doing row locking for 7.0. So I was all about, you know, the transactions and consistency. Still am. My point is, at what scope does it make sense? And the example that I shared around Exchange Hosted Archive, the ability to do the alter table but not have to have it be in a single distributed transaction, and in essence not losing anything from a consistency standpoint and gaining a lot in terms of availability, more and more people are recognizing that I can give up this much in consistency and achieve this much in availability. So being smart about that is where a lot of the focus and the value of the systems you see at scale today. And, of course, HA that just works. One of the things that we didn't talk about in the context of SQL Azure is that under the covers, the system is actually using, at a high level, a replication protocol, which is splitting everything up across the way we have it configured, three different disks, if you will. And as disks fail and as servers fail, the system just keeps going. So our first experience at this was on this Exchange Hosted Archive system, where at that scale, roughly a disk drive a week failed, and the system just reconfigured and kept going. Roughly a server per month at that scale ran into some sort of problem, would restart, and the system would reconfigure and keep going. So the system recognizes failures of various forms, will automatically initiate a recovery. So if a disk fails that holds a number of partitions, that disk may hold some primary partitions and some secondary partitions. We'll do a role reversal, so anything that was primary will elect another secondary to be primary. And let's say that is not coming back. We know the disk is gone and it's not coming back. Now we're down to two copies of the data. We'll say that let's get back to three. So the system will locate machines across the cluster that have the room and the capability, and we obey a set of topology constraints. We don't want to put primaries and secondaries on the same machine behind the same switch. So we look at that, and then automatically we'll instantiate new replicas to get back up to the desired safety factor, replication factor for the system. So that's HA that just works without having to worry about it. So in the system, disks are failing all the time. It's not even sort of any form of emergency on our side. We can just kind of go through periodically and clean things out. So talk a little bit about big data. So this one I've spent a lot of time on in the last 18 months. I wish we had never used the word big because I find that when I start at big, the conversation is not all that great. In fact, do I have it in my pocket? I gave a talk at one of the database research conferences in August, and I wanted to make the point about it's not big. So since March, I've been carrying this. It's a GPS data logger around. So I did a keynote at this conference, and I said the title was, "Is it still big data if it fits in my pocket?" So basically, I built a bunch of the patterns, the big data patterns, at megabyte scale. And one of the things I used as input was the GPS telemetry. But big is just one dimension. I think we lose a lot of the value if we just stay there. One of the analyst firms referred to it as your three V's and the C. It's about volume, variety, velocity, and complexity. It might be computation. I don't know if the C is correct, quite correct. But drivers, here's the interesting thing for me. The cost of data acquisition, I'll assert, has gone to zero. So we used to pay armies of people to type the stuff in. Now it's just available. Even inherently analog phenomena, photographs, your voice on the cell phone. And you can still find people in the U.S. to type things in for you. And whether it's manuscript typing or data entry, it's roughly $1 per kilobyte. And so it costs you about $1.10 to get the Gettysburg Address. Costs you about $1,000 to get Moby Dick, and if you scale it up to a petabyte, it's a really, really big number. But now we don't have to go out and do that. And the cost of data storage has dramatically reduced. I used to say it's gone to zero as well, but that would get all my storage buddies and hackles, because, you know. But we're at this interesting point whereby if the perceived latent value of this data that's just available, sometimes referred to as ambient data, is greater than the cost to acquire and store it, then you're at a tipping point. There's no reason to throw anything away. I'm going to hang on to it because I know it's valuable or potentially valuable. And if you think about the elements of cost, one of the things that is really expensive these days is how do I model the data? And the way we've traditionally built systems, we've kind of gone from information back to data back to signal. We've built information models to answer a set of questions. And one of the challenges is if we have a new question, we sometimes, quite often, have to go change the model. And this sometimes we refer to as the data warehousing cliff. Works really great if the schema and the model has considered the questions you want to ask. But if you ask a question that hasn't been considered, you kind of run into a cliff. And what we have done, coming from a world where we thought about this stuff as expensive and scarce, when we did the ETL, and you know, the way we've traditionally done things, we kind of threw things out as soon as possible. In the big data world, I talked about if you get that tipping point, you just hang on to it. You can go back and recompute it. So getting from signal to data to information and knowledge, and then being able to take insight and action on that knowledge, that's really what this is all about. And it has been about for a long time. Now, I'm going to give you one concrete example of where a lot of the value is here. And if you can lock this example in, I think it'll help you reason about a lot of it. So imagine in the world, and we're going to describe some of this here in the next few minutes, you've heard of some of the big data tooling, you've heard of Hadoop, you've heard of other things. So you build what pattern I've been referring to as a digital shoebox. You just collect stuff up and you throw it in there. Now imagine that you can pretty much write any query you can dream of over that. You don't have to build the model first. And you're going to solve that query by brute force. So you're just, you know, the system is inherently designed to parallelize and just grind through it and give you an answer in bounded time. And let's just say, for sake of argument, you can produce an answer in this environment in 2 hours. For pretty much most anything, you can just have to go through all the data and plow through it. You say, wow, 2 hours, that's pretty lousy query response time. But, okay, here's the trick. In the world that the traditional world we're coming from, if that was a novel question, if it wasn't already considered in the schema, if the data wasn't already loaded in the data warehouse in the right way, that two-hour response might turn into a two-month response because I got to go talk to one guy who's got to talk to another guy who's got to go change the schema, who's got to go find the guy who's going to load the data and, you know, that. So it's the time to insight. The fact that if I have to go get someone to change things, I got to go ETL and I might have thrown the stuff away so I can't get a historical look on it, to the fact that I can write some brute force query and validate that novel question in 2 hours instead of 2 months, that's where a lot of the value is. Okay. Now, let's say that once you answer that question once, because that's an important question. 2 hours isn't going to cut it. I need to have that be able to produce that answer in a second or two. Then you go through the rest of the work to model it to put it in there, but you don't have to do that up front before you realize whether the question's even worth asking or not. Okay? That, if you just stick that and file that away, you'll be smarter than many people I run into on the big data topic. So there's your tip for the day. Okay, so characteristics. It's about new data sources, non-traditional data types. If I were to give you the two-hour talk on big data, one of the things I'd talk about and spend a fair bit of time on is what I call information production. And that's transforming data from one form into information of another. I'll go back to my little GPS telemetry here. So one of the things I did, I've got this stream of GPS telemetry. I wrote some queries, if you will, that determine when I am, I call it a dwell time, when I'm actually standing still, not moving, versus when I'm actually going from one place to another. Now, with that, I can then say, oh, geez, when am I home? When am I at work? Okay. Another thing I did is I just produced a log file out of Outlook that tells me when I send mail. So by combining these two forms of information, I can easily write a query that says, ooh, how much email do I send when I'm at home versus when I'm at work? And that's kind of a depressing thing sometimes. But it's really interesting, but this is changing from a domain of GPS telemetry into a domain of events and states in which I can pull out when I'm home and when I'm at work. Okay, so it's information production. Another thing that I did is I produced a set of acceptors. So I can say a dwell at home followed by taking a path to work, and then a dwell at work is a commute to work. Given that, it's really easy for me to pose a query, what is my commute time as a function of when I leave the house in the morning? But this, I'm trying to get back to this point of the potential, the latent value in these data. And if they're for free and I can store them for very low cost, I can just dream up new ways to use it. And this information production turns it from a log file, from GPS telemetry, into things that make more sense to the business. Okay, so that's another one of the common patterns here. So new questions, new insights. So now there's a thing called Hadoop some of you might have heard of. And we're going to learn a little bit more about it in a couple minutes. But Microsoft has, actually it's interesting, Microsoft is one of the few companies on the planet, few entities on the planet, that is in playing with producing value out of hundreds of petabytes of data in our online services business. And we have our own set of technologies for going off and doing that. So why Hadoop for Microsoft? Well, one of the things is we have a fairly significant data warehousing business. And we'd go out in the field and our customers would say, what is your Hadoop story? Not your big data story, your Hadoop story. And another thing, and this again for people understanding this point, some people look at this as just being one's going to subsume the other and this sort of the big debate. People, in reality, in many, many use cases, they're quite complementary. And if I spend a little time with people who have experienced, they quite quickly figure out where to draw the line in terms of using the traditional technologies in, coupled with sort of the newer big data technologies like Hadoop. Some real-world examples you can go look at. Yahoo is creating, or has a last count it was 24 terabyte analysis services cube that they're populating from Hadoop. There's a company called Clout, and I actually have the URL at the bottom, that is doing social relevance scoring for people. I think one of the founders came from Yahoo, but they're again using Hadoop, populating an analysis services cube. There's a great blog post on why they did this, and the value and how they fit together. So if you're at all interested in that, you can track down the URL at the bottom. And you just go to clout.com, K-L-O-U-T, and just search in the blog, and you can find that. Okay, so we wanted a great port of Hadoop for Windows. So if our customers wanted to have a Hadoop story, we wanted great connectivity. So we built a connector, ODBC driver. There's a technology called Scoop for importing and exporting data with that. And then we also wanted to have Hadoop run well on Windows because no one had really taken the time to create a great Windows port. So we are working very closely with the Apache community, getting our changes back into the open source world. And even beyond that, something I'm going to show you in a couple minutes is there's a lot of work, if you looked at what Scott was talking about, and sort of Node.js, JavaScript, there's a lot happening there. And we have invested in JavaScript in and around Hadoop to be able to do map and reduce functions, write them in JavaScript in a very easy way we're going to show you in just a couple minutes. So that's the why we're doing that. And the architecture, there's only one thing I want to talk about here. There's a layer in the middle where there's reliable distributed storage underneath, and then there's sort of the MapReduce framework. And then there are a number of things above this picture. Languages for querying Hive, Pig, other machine learning environments. One of the things we want to be able to do here is through some of the other API mechanisms in Hadoop, ultimately we've done technology investigations around how do we get a great Visual Studio .NET experience on top of that. Can we write things in Link in a way that makes sense? So a lot of some investment, we're starting off there. Building an environment that's leveraging something that exists and yet producing a great, great experience for people who have a lot of investment in the Microsoft technology stack. The layer at the bottom, HDFS, the Hadoop Distributed File System, is sort of what comes with a lot of people using that. There are also people who have built, so Amazon's EMR is built on sort of Hadoop, if you will, over S3. You can imagine us doing the same thing over other forms of storage we talked about earlier today. People have built connectors into database systems. And so that's a way to get at different forms of data, do a different form of processing. And quite often, as I said earlier, people take the results of that and they place it into a relational database, into a OLAP cube or other forms, or actually sit in Excel. And we have something we're not going to show today, but the ability to go Hive ODBC against Hadoop and then get the results right back in Excel. So interesting way of pulling the pieces together end-to-end in the data platform. So with that, Wenwing's going to come out and show Hadoop for us. And you're going to show something that others probably haven't seen in it, right?
Hi, okay. Dave.
Sure. Take it away.
Hi. Let's see. So can we please switch over to demo number 4?
There we go.
Okay, great. Thanks. Well, what we have done this past few months is that to actually provide a Windows Server version of the Hadoop story, and then we also did a web portal. So this web portal is called Apache Hadoop-based service for Windows Azure. It's currently in CTP, and you can actually go to that website right now, which is hadoop on azure.com, and you can join the CTP program by creating yourself an account on connect.microsoft.com. So what I am going to show is how easy it is to be able to provision a cluster and then immediately being productive and starting to do a MapReduce job right there on the management console. There's no tools to install. There's no, almost nothing you would have to learn about what MapReduce is. So we're going to do a classic example of word count, and then we're also going to show people about how Hive could work in this system. So when we log into the portal, the first thing you'll see is that it's a very humorous implementation of the Hadoop.
Map for that.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the things that it tried to embarrass me the other day was that it says, friends don't let friends count words. So it's mocking me about my little demo here. But we're going to go ahead and show the control panel. So we have a JavaScript interactive console. And the second part is for somebody who wants to log into the cluster. So for those of us who are not familiar with the concept of Hadoop, the idea is to take commodity hardware and make a cluster out of it. And then you put HDFS, which is Hadoop Distributed File System, that sits on top of it. Mm-hmm. It will take care of the redundancy. It will distribute the files for you automatically.
Yep.
And on top of that, there's the other the upper part, which you talked about, which is to take the be able to map the jobs to where the data is. So that's the most important part, which is taking your compute code and move that to where the data is on the cluster. So, and the other part is that you would be able to take your data and copy it through FTPS. You can turn that port on and off. And we previously mentioned the ODBC driver, Hive driver, which is also available. I have both of these ports open. And also, there's a way of managing data. So, since the portal is running on Azure, this particular instance is running on 8 medium commodity worker roles. So we don't have any specialized hardware underneath. It's simply using commodity worker roles that we have. So we have 3.78 terabytes of storage on that. And you can import data from Azure Blob Storage by entering your username and passkey. And then there's we also support Amazon S3, as well as being able to import data from the data market.
One of the interesting things here is, so basically you're bringing it into local non-persistent storage, that local file system I talked way back about.
Yeah.
And then often what people will do is you'll have petabyte scale data that you'll reduce sometimes in the word count. If I'm going to get, what's the frequency of the top 100 words, I've got a kilobyte result.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
So, and that may go to Excel or some other file. There's a huge, in many of these jobs, a huge reduction in this phase.
Yeah. And you want to keep all the data where they are.
Yep.
In our case, it's the internet, basically. So we're going to go back here. I'm going to run the interactive console, which is really nice. This is something that we, the Isotope team, has implemented.
Isotope is the internal code name.
The internal code name. What's really nice about it is that JavaScript fits really well in a web-based environment. Mm-hmm. And I can simply start typing, and there's no Java tools to install. And you know, for those of you who don't know Hadoop, you actually have to have Java development tool to run a MapReduce. Mm-hmm. So there's no cluster to install, and there's also no tools to install. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start putting my word count program up to the actual cluster.
So you're going to be brave enough to type it in?
Yes, I will.
Okay, while you do that, one of the things I'll mention is if you've been looking at some of the NoSQL stores, some of them actually specify views and do view definitions in terms of JavaScript map and reduce functions.
Yeah, that's right. And my file is somewhere in here. There you go. So we're going to upload that. As you can see, interacting with the file system, with your local file system, is even extremely easy. So we're going to do a cat, which is your typical command for looking at a file. We're going to say word count.js. And for a MapReduce program, it's really simple in terms of writing the actual program. There's two parts to it. The first part is the mapping part, where you're actually distributing the work across the cluster. or two different processes. Mm-hmm. And the second part is aggregating the data back, which is the reduced part. So
that's part of the, if you go back to the magic, I said, look, I might be able to do it in 2 hours.
Yeah.
I didn't have to build the schema. Here you're actually parsing whatever is available in the log files to induce, if you will, the schema over, and then those get reduced to produce the result.
Right. And in terms of data, I have, here's the trick for looking at the actual HDFS. I can simply type a pound sign. It will show me all the commands that are available to it. So I can say dash ls Gutenberg. Gutenberg is a project where they take some of the books that have copyrights expired. Mm-hmm. So we can simply, you know, copy a few of those. And there's Moby Dick right there. Yeah. Free words. And what we want to do is to go ahead and do a word count on this, all these text. So for a simple divide and conquer method, we're simply run it, and the hypothesis is that the Hadoop job program, the job scheduler, would actually automatically send that out to the cluster. So one process for each of these text. So I am not actually brave enough to type in that command. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to say cat query dot text. So and I'll explain this little query in a little bit. So I'm going to copy that and paste it back into the console. And instead of sending it to nowhere, I'm going to send it to a little file. Actually, it's a part of Hadoop. We're going to say top 10 words. And I'm going to press enter.
Now, the cool thing about this is just an environment. You just walk up, step up, start learning.
That's right. Yep. Exactly. And let me explain this query a little bit. The first part is that you're taking the from Gutenberg, which is your data set is, and you're going to run a map reduce program, which in my case is wordcount.js. Mm-hmm. You saw the mapping portion of it, and then there's the reduce part. And we are going to use the words and count. Since JavaScript doesn't have a type, we actually have to specify that. Mm-hmm. Then you order it by whoever has the largest number of count for words. And we're going to take the top 10, which is your reduction. We got 10 words. And we're going to save it. We're going to save that. So if I click on the view log, so once you press enter, the magic actually happens behind the scenes. What's really happening is our smart engineers who are here at Microsoft actually compile that JavaScript down to Pig Latin, which is a workflow engine for Hadoop. So as you can see, the map reduce process has started like any batch processing system in the good old days and also in the world of high-performance computing as well. Things tend to take a long time. So we're going to this is probably going to take about 5 minutes or so, but we already have some...
The interesting thing is because it's there's a huge startup cost.
Yeah,
so for small jobs, it is, you know, but for the large jobs, the idea is you can just plow through it brute force and get, it's that first answer.
That's
not
right.
Having to go build everything else out.
And I have 8 nodes here. So if I had 8 books that I want to parse, it will take almost exactly the same amount of time. And so the other part I want to show you is that some of the new features they added, which is be able to plot the data and interact with data right there. So you don't need to bring up any heavyweight tools. So I'm going to type that in. So for the file is called Gutenberg, file.rs, which is, you know, the file reader object, and .read. Actually, hold on 1 second. I want to make sure that I have it right. So it's fs, not rs. So I'm going to say file.fs.read, the gb top 10, got a quote in there. And we don't have syntax highlighting a little yet, so I got spoiled with the syntax highlighting. So as you can see, the top word is D, and those are the top words that you see very often in a set of words. What the next thing I'm going to do is to actually read that into a data structure. So data equals parse. This is our the semi-structured schema, if you Let's just say that. File.data, which is, you know, the data that I read in. And I'm going to parse that into Word and a comma, count long. I forgot a quote there. And that's going to work. So now I parse that into a vector, and I would be able to simply use the graph object, bar, to do a plot. And if I want a pie chart, it's even easier. I can just type pie. And if you want help on any of the features, you can simply type help. And so let's actually look at if our job actually finished. Job.list. You can see that's the latest one that we submitted. Batch systems take a long time,
it's
still going at it. So
close to done.
Yeah, that's right. But I'm typing faster than the Hadoop can do its job today. Yeah. So I.
So the cool thing here is, if you just want to be able to profile some things, take a look at it. This is not meant to be a deep analytics environment, but just does it make sense? Sort of the sniff test, if you will, over the results, right?
Right, and also it's a good way of kind of for anybody who hasn't actually played with a MapReduce to just simply go on there and do something. And there's no Java to learn, but we do, you know, we do support, and actually Hadoop itself supports multiple languages like Python, like Ruby, even .NET. The second thing I want to show you is a query that I ran earlier. So this is a Hive query. So I want to explain what Hive is a little bit. Hive is more of a structured data that sits on top of the Hadoop layer. And the point of this is that you'll be able to run your regular SQL query against it. But there's no magic behind this because you're using commodity hardware. You have this MapReduce framework that's sitting underneath. And that still is going to take you a long time. So let's actually look at this query. So what we did is we actually wanted to know the top 10 most violent crime that happens in the U.S. So the top one is obviously New York because they have a lot more population. They have the largest population. And here's the actual run log. You can see that the MapReduce happens, and then the second piece, the second part of the job happens where we're doing the ordering. And it takes about, you know, it takes a long time.
Yep.
So it's just nature of a...
But if you think about this in the context of information production, as I mentioned earlier, quite often you'll produce a set that will feed subsequent analysis. Yeah. Someone can just work with that set for a week or so and you know, come up some other conclusions.
And there's all this open data set that are out in the world because, you know, City of Chicago is dumping two dumps to open data out to the public. And you can do very interesting things with that. So I just copied that same query, and I can go back and go to the Hive you know, interactive console and go ahead and evaluate. It will run that query again. While I'm at it, I still want to make sure that we actually finish that job for the JavaScript. So job.list. And here it is. And hopefully I see a success. And it did finish properly. So that's kind of what we have to show. And we also have one last thing I would like to say. There's more. The ability to save your session. So all the stuff that I did earlier, I can simply call up a session dot load learn Azure. See, this is a session that I saved earlier. You can simply go back to it.
Yep.
So this enables online sharing and the other possibilities that we have.
Fantastic. So,
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you very much. Great stuff. So really taking friction out of it, and we'll land this fairly quickly now. If we can switch back to the slides, I only have one more to close. The thing that is interesting there, if you think about data as a developer being more interesting to the experiences you want to develop, the thing we didn't connect the dots on is we have a data market. Much of this open government data is available there. The ability to derive insights out of that, include those in applications and experiences you want to build, is aided by the technology. So we make it very easy to reference a data set that may be publicly available or something that you've subscribed to on the data market, reference that in this type of environment, produce something that then you can incorporate and use in the experiences. So Scott talked about building mobile experiences. Those are powered by a cloud backend that may have a variety of needs in terms of storage. One of the things that, again, we didn't spend a lot of time connecting, but as you accumulate information from those sort of experiences, what's the big data processing in which you can reason about that and figure out how people are using, how you can improve the experience? So all of what you need is available here in Azure in various forms of storage. And if I pop the stack a little bit, one of the things I've really tried to do today is to just get a little bit of a frame in terms of how to think about the options and how to think about the needs and use cases and when to map them to various options, and to be able to say that you have choices along one dimension or another. If you want to think about things from a pure entity flexible model using Azure Table Storage, whether you want to leverage the skills and relational database solution makes sense, but you want to be able to scale it in a flexible way using federations, those choices are available to you. So hopefully along the learn dimension, we've covered a lot of ground. You can get started, just head to the portal and away you go, and give us some feedback. So thanks for your time. Hope you found it useful. Thank you.